Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have a figure familiar to First Things readers, Father Thomas Guarino, who is professor of systematic theology at Seton Hall University, and most familiarly to us, co-chair of Evangelicals and Catholics Together, which we'll have another meeting here in the First Things office and issue another report, statement that you'll see in the magazine not long from now. He's also the author of many works. He's a professor, a teacher, and a scholar, one including Foundations of Systematic Theology from 2005, and most recently, The Disputed Teachings of Vatican II, Continuity and Reversal in Catholic Doctrine, which is our topic today. Welcome, Father Guarino.
Thank you, Mark. Great to be here.
Professor Father Guarino, do you have a preference? Herr Professor Father.
Well, as the Germans say, doctor.
Doctor. Now, in Italian, il professore.
Professor
Guarino. Okay, very good. Now, first, we'll ask about the book, but I don't get the title, The Disputed Teachings of Vatican II. Vatican II, it's very simple. It means right. Something. The message is very clear. All it means is just liberalization of everything, correct?
It's exactly how it's been interpreted. You're exactly right, Mark.
Okay.
That's right. Didn't this council ruin the church?
What we can actually go into, chapter one is entitled The Central Problem of Vatican II. So why don't you give us, what is the central problem of Vatican II?
Well, I think, Mark, that can be illustrated by a conversation that took place in December 1964 between Christian Fouché, who was the French National Minister of Education, and Bishop Elkinger of Strasbourg, France. And Fouché said to Elkinger, you're doing a terrible job at the council. You're changing everything. What was true yesterday is no longer true today. And Yves Congar mentions this in his diary, his conciliar journal, and he says, well, this is just the French press stirring up headlines and confusing people. But I disagree with Congar. I think Fouché was onto something, because people think that somehow Vatican II changed everything. And this is the central problem, because, as I argue, continuity is inscribed in the Catholic soul. In the 17th century, Jean-Jacques Bossuet wrote a book called The History of Variations in Protestantism. And basically, he was a Catholic apologist, and he was a little bit nasty, as most 17th century authors were. But he said, you know, Protestantism changes, and that's why we know it's erroneous. Catholicism stays the same. But I think the insight Bossuet had is that, right, Catholicism stakes a great deal on the continuity of the message of Christ and the apostolic tradition, and that this has been preserved in the church over the course of time. But I think people have the sense that somehow Vatican II betrayed that, was a council of rupture rather than continuity. So the central problem is, what did Vatican II really do, and how is it understood and interpreted?
And is it something that you can easily determine? I mean, in some ways, if you take an adjustment, a revision, so something different.
Yes.
And you can see people really understand it in the exact same way, but one person could call this a distortion.
Right.
And another person would call this a proper evolution.
Right.
And does the text do those initial the authoritative conversations give you enough material to make a reasoned judgment one way or the other, or are we stuck with people of different presuppositions and outlooks looking at the same thing and seeing something different?
Yeah, that's a great question, Mark. I think that, first of all, I'd like to say one of the things I do in the book is use Vincent of Lorenz. Vincent of Lorenz was a 5th century theologian, a monk who lived in southern France. There's still a monastery there today on the island of Lorenz. And he was writing in 434, he tells us. And he says, the church has changed from the time of Christ. We're using words like homoousion in the creed, that Jesus is consubstantial with the Father. That word is not in Scripture. And just prior to that, just prior to his writing, there had been another ecumenical council, Ephesus, which referred to the Blessed Mother as the Theotokos, the God-bearer or the Mother of God. And Vincent says, the church is changing over the 400 years. But he said there's two, and this was, I think, brilliant, because he's the only ancient Christian writer who kind of deals with history head on. And he says, change is inevitable in life.
So in the second century or the third century, this isn't really an issue.
Right.
They're close enough. The church is changing. You're close. Right.
They're close enough to the apostolic witness. But now you're starting, by the early fifth century, you're starting to see some distance. You're starting to see new words used to describe the faith. And Vincent really reflects on this, and he says, you know, in life, we see children grow into adults. We see seeds grow into plants. He says there's change as part of life. And the church, he brilliantly says, some might say, is there no change in the Church of Christ? He said, there's great change. Mm-hmm. Plane et maximus, he says.
I'm gonna read the quote.
Good, beautiful.
Because you make a lot out of this quotation. It's on page 13.
Good.
Where he says, just what you're saying. But someone will perhaps say, is there no progress of religion in the Church of Christ? Certainly there is progress, even exceedingly great progress. And there you get the plane et maximus. For who is so envious of others and so hateful toward God as to try to prohibit it? Yet it must be an advance in the proper sense of the word and not an alteration, permutatio, in faith. Progress means that each thing is enlarged within itself.
Right.
And is that what you mean when you talk about this as organic growth?
So the change that is organic, I use the word architectonic, harmonious, linear, that's the kind of change that Vincent sees as proportionate, as legitimate. That's legitimate advance.
Mm-hmm.
But he says a pernicious corruption, a permutatio, is a reversal of a fundamental teaching. Now, why was Vincent concerned about this? Because there had been several imperial attempts to reverse the Nicene Creed, because some people did not like that word, homoousios, that Jesus is of the same substance as the Father. So various alleged synonyms were proposed. Jesus is of a similar substance as the Father. So Vincent saw this kind of a reversal of a fundamental landmark of the church as a corruption. That's a permutatio.
So there are some areas where there's a clear line.
Yes, exactly.
That you can draw. He puts it in the end of the quote, Progress must be made according to its own type.
Right. Exactly.
So there must be some essential, by type he means some
again,
inner form.
And, right. And that's why the biological examples are so important. You know, a child becoming an adult, a seed becoming a plant. Vincent adduces those and says, yeah, here we see the essence, the nature of a thing mm-hmm. is not changed.
Mm-hmm.
Growth within the same nature, that's the kind of growth we want. But he says, if you have a reversal of something, that's a change, which is obviously a deviation. So I use Vincent to say, how does he help us understand the council?
All right, so if we look at something like the ordination of women.
Right.
What is the argument there against the ordination of women as a non-organic, a violation of the type?
Right.
Of ordination.
Well, Vincent would say, of course, Vatican II, first, let's say Vatican II never dealt with that question.
Yeah.
So
I was trying to take, if you want to take a more subtle, subtle example, go ahead.
Right. So, I mean, let's talk a little bit about, of something Vatican II dealt with. But let's come back to that question because that's a good contemporary question. But here's where I would say we saw proportionate expansion of a teaching of the church, and that would be the collegiality of bishops. The theologians at Vatican I ended in 1870, the first Vatican Council. Now everybody knows that Vatican I defined the infallibility of the papal magisterium, that under certain very restrictive conditions, the Pope can teach infallibly. Now, the council intended to do something about the bishops, but the political situation broke up the council. They couldn't finish their work. So at Vatican II, there was a very heated debate on the authority of bishops. what they wanted to do at Vatican II, said, look, the Pope doesn't stand alone in a kind of pontifical aloofness, but the Pope is surrounded by the world's bishops who represent the Catholics from all over the world, and they teach together. So there was it was really a three-year struggle, this whole question of collegiality. But ultimately, Vatican II says, yes, only together with the Pope. Vincent would surely say this was a harmonious development because papal infallibility was not threatened. That was not reversed in any way. Mm-hmm. But it was simply added that the universal episcopacy, together with Peter, can also teach with supreme authority.
Okay.
So that's an example. Another example would be the universal priesthood of all the faithful. You know, one of the things that at the time of the Reformation, of course, one of Luther's main theses was that all of us are priests in a sense. And one Peter speaks about that, the royal priesthood, the baptismal priesthood. Now, in Catholicism, that was eclipsed at the time of the Reformation because Luther unfortunately denied the ministerial priesthood. So Trent spent all of its time upholding the ordained priest and didn't advert to the ministerial to the baptismal priesthood. So Vatican II talked about the baptismal priesthood, how all Christians baptized into the Christ share in the priesthood of Jesus Christ, but without jeopardizing the ministerial priesthood.
Finding historical sanction is one mode of proof.
Right, exactly.
Of organic or proportionate development.
Right, okay.
So it is very important, and that's the continuity
argument. And that's why sometimes with Vatican II, you will hear the word ressourcement.
Right.
Or back to the sources, ad fontes, that this is looking at the history of Christianity and then saying, what can we learn from the history of the faith and how can we bring these resources to bear on contemporary issues?
Right. I want to come back to those three words those three key words in the middle of the book, ressourcement being one of them. But so you find that Vincent gives us conceptions of proper progress. You also go to Cardinal Newman.
People don't know this about Cardinal Newman, but when he was 33 years old, he translated Vincent into English. He had an enduring influence on his life. You know, people, I still read articles which say the inventor of the development of doctrine was John Henry Newman. Baloney. Huh. John Henry Newman, at the age of 33, translated not quite all, but almost all of the Commonatorium, Vincent's book, with footnotes and influenced him deeply the rest of his life. So Newman adds several notes. He adds such as identity of type must be kept over time. He developed some of Vincent's ideas on...
And uses some of the same language.
Same language. Yeah. And also, you know, you ask a good question that I think, you know, goes to the heart of what both Vincent and Newman are interested in. How do you determine what is a legitimate advance and what is not a legitimate advance? So Vincent, and Newman picks this up, he would say, first, obviously, we have the scriptures. So Vincent says, everything that we believe is in the scriptures. However, he says, we all know that everybody interprets the scriptures differently. And in fact, Vincent tells a few jokes, I always say. He says, you know, a distinguishing mark of heretics is they always have 1,000 scriptural citations. So I thought that was pretty funny. So his point is that the Bible can be interpreted differently. He said, even though it's more than sufficient. Yeah. So he says, where do we look to find the teachings of Christ? How do we know that scripture is being interpreted properly? And Newman picks this up. Vincent says, ecumenical councils. Because they represent the faith of Christians from all over the world. The bishops represent their local churches and hand on the apostolic tradition. So Vincent talks about ecumenical councils first, but he says not everything's always decided by an ecumenical council. Where else can we look? He says holy and learned theologians, and he mentions the Bishop of Rome and the universal faith of the people. So Vincent gives us criteria, which Newman picks up and develops later on.
And it is bound to be a very slow, deliberate process.
Right.
Which, you know, I've heard people say, oh, the Catholic Church, you know, it's glacial.
Yeah, right.
I said, yes, that's one of the wonderful things
that's
about
right.
it.
Vincent says centuries.
Let's not be in a hurry.
In centuries to develop before eodem sensuae demque sententia.
Huh. You nonetheless call Vatican II a wholesale paradigm shift.
Yes.
You know, the Kuhn radical adjustment in just deep root premises.
Yeah. And just to say for a minute, you know, I disagree with Thomas Kuhn completely on his epistemology, but I always think that's such a brilliant book in terms of how change occurs. I think it's probably one of the best books.
He was good on institutions.
Right.
Maybe not on the deep, deep epistemology, but the way institutions work.
And the sociology of institutions and the profession, how the profession.
Right.
So anyway, you know, as you point out, Mark, Kuhn talks about paradigm shift, and I do think there was a significant one which caused kind of the vertigo in the post-conciliar church, which is, and again, you know, here's where I would take into account the sociology of the council. It opened October 11, 1962. Now, as I always say, the council had 2,400 bishops from around the world. It had theologians from around the world. But the motors in both the episcopacy and the theologians were the Europeans.
So if a council were held today that had representation from Africa and Southeast Asia, you wouldn't have the talk about reaching out to the world and somehow maybe even being so concerned about religious pluralism, is that right?
Right, I think you're absolutely right, Mark. And first of all, as a general principle, one ecumenical council always balances its predecessors. So, I mean, we're social and historical beings. So, and councils are held to deal with determinate issues. So the 1960s, after the war, in the middle of the Cold War, after the Holocaust, it was trying to, how can we have links among men? I think if a council were held today, especially with a strong African participation, which would certainly be the case, it would be much more, what is the distinctiveness of the Catholic faith? What is the distinctiveness of Christianity? What are some of the problems that exist with the world? Vatican II, I mean, for example, words like dissident, heretic, schismatic, that you had always seen in prior ecumenical, nowhere to be found in Vatican II. Mm-hmm. You know, I always say the Catholic Church recognizes 20 ecumenical councils. The First Council of Nicaea, 325, the 20th Council, Vatican II, 1962. 19 of those councils out of 20 had condemnations. Vatican II was the first ecumenical council with no condemnations. And John the 23rd in his opening speech says, you know, in the past, the church has used discipline. With this council, the church will use the medicine of mercy. So these became the themes of the council and how the council expressed itself rhetorically.
So finally, with your three keywords, development, resourcement, aggiornamento.
Mm-hmm.
What is development?
So development, I say, is harmonious. That's what Vincent
the organic
and Newman,
growth, right.
They both say this. So we can't call everything at Vatican II itself a development. You know, I would not say that the decree on ecumenism is a development. It's it's part of the process of development because it was not a harmonious growth or proportion or expansion of an original teaching. It was a reversal of a teaching. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, that's part of the process of development, but not a development per se.
Now are the reversals in Vatican II acknowledged as reversals, which means that they have a little more of a historical character that could be open to being themselves reversed in the future?
Yeah, well, I mean, right, Vatican II, everyone would say, first of all, Vatican II defined nothing infallibly.
Okay.
So there's no, unlike Vatican I, unlike the Council of Trent, however, it's an exercise of the supreme magisterium of the church with and under the Pope. So obviously, especially in the two dogmatic constitutions on the church and divine revelation, these are really grave teachings of the church. I would not expect them to be reversed at any time in the future.
Okay.
But yes, your point is that some of it, especially even the titles, notice, you know, I always point this out to my students. The 16 documents of Vatican II have different titles. These different titles were not given, you know, for the sake of variety. They were given to indicate different weight. So a dogmatic constitution, which is the dogma of the church, there are only two at Vatican II, is different from a decree or a declaration, which would have lower level of authority.
Ressourcement
is to go back to, I mean, there was a tremendous move that was sometimes judged pejoratively, but I think was helpful to say, you know, look, St. Thomas Aquinas is a wonderful theologian, but we can't just live on the conceptual apparatus of the 13th century. So in the 30s and 40s, you had a raft of theologians saying, we have to go back to the Bible. We have to go back to the ancient Christian writers. How can we renew the church? And you know what? A lot of this started in France. And it's not surprising. I mean, France, as you know, in the late 1930s was becoming an increasingly communist country. So Henri de Lubac, one of the great French ressourcement theologians, he said, look at what the communists are doing. They're taking words like fraternity, charity, concern for the poor. He said, these are Christian themes. Our people don't understand these are Christian themes. So the idea was, let's take the ancient Christian writers who themselves were living in the Roman Empire. They themselves were living in a pagan culture and say, how did these first Christian witnesses, how did they live their faith? To put these, and the idea was, put cheap paperbacks in the hands of the French people, of the ancient Christian writers, and the language of those, unlike the kind of the abstract, abstruse language of Aquinas, it was more concrete living, and to say, look at how these men and women live their lives, how can we live our lives today?
Okay, and aggiornamento.
And aggiornamento, you know, I was, in November of 1965, Paul VI gave a great speech. He said, aggiornamento, or bringing up to date in Italian, a word that Pope John XXIII had used, does not mean relativizing the faith. It means living out the council. So sometimes people think that idea, you know, aggiornamento means the church bowing to culture, but it's just the opposite. I mean, throughout the history of the church, now, John 23rd certainly wanted the Christian faith to be spoken in a language contemporary women and men could understand. That was important to him. And he also wanted ecumenical sensitivity. So in that sense, he wanted the form of Catholicism to change. I think we could even say, you know, I wrote this in the book, that for John the 23rd, Catholicism was experiencing a crisis of form, not a crisis of content. That he was concerned that the language of the faith had become too abstruse and abstract, that the liturgy had become too far removed from the people. It was the priest on the altar with an altar boy in Latin. And I think he saw the form of the faith had to be renewed and reinvigorated, keeping the content. Mm-hmm. But he makes that crucial distinction in his opening speech between, he says, the deposit of faith is one thing, the way in which it is communicated another. And he ends with Vincent, eodem sensue, ademque sententia, according to the same nature and the same judgment.
I think that's a good point on which to conclude.
Wonderful, Mark.
Thank you, Father Guarino. I want to mention the title of the book for everyone. The Disputed Teachings of Vatican II by Father Guarino, and it is published with Erdmann's Press.
Erdmann's Press.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Great to be here. Thank you.